Spirit Radio Podcasts.
It was reported a few weeks ago that seven Uyghur Christians have been imprisoned in China and sentenced to between 5 and 7 years in prison. They're crying, preaching and gathering and spreading books. In studio now to tell us more, we have David Turner, Director of Irish Charity, Church in Chains. You are very welcome back to the show, David. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, Ronan.
So first of all, David, talk to us about religious freedom in China, or R&D lack thereof.
Yeah, well, I suppose it's a very interesting day to be focusing on China. It's China's National Day. There's huge events going on in China, the marking 70th anniversary of the victory of the Chinese Communist forces. So I woke up this morning to have a look at some of the footage coming in from China. So there's this huge military parade.
Of course, yeah.
Yeah, and interesting to see President Xi Jinping. Some of us in Ireland will remember that before he became president, he visited Ireland on kind of a PR trip.
He did. I remember him like hitting the Hurley.
The Hurley, yeah, that's the right, image yeah, that you yeah. think. Well, you're not hitting a Hurley today. Today yeah. he's in a motorcade yeah. and he's dressed in a Chairman Mao suit.
Wow.
And, you know, it's just a display of pride in what China has achieved in those 70 years, but many people also viewing it as kind of an expression of force, you know, China,
of course,
growing force in the world.
Like, what else are those things for? Like, yes. you know, effectively, what is the massive, you know, military parade? It's to say, look how strong and powerful we are, isn't it?
It is. It yeah. is indeed. And, you know, the Chairman Mao suit is not a mistake.
No.
Nothing
not
is
by
a mistake.
Accident. I totally take your point. It's there's something kind of, it's so interesting because, you know, one of our other correspondents that we talk to regularly here, you know, really has the effect of what's going on at the very, what I suppose we would have called the Politburo when it came to the old Soviet thing. That group, he describes it almost like a mafia, you know, where they, you know, they rule with an iron will. They talk about communism, but really, at the end of the day, it's all about making money. It's kind of a weird, weird setup, and they are kind of frightening, aren't they, those people?
Yeah, well, I mean, at the start, you asked me about freedom of religion in China, and, you know, it's extremely limited. And with this president, it's gone to a new level.
Really?
It's gone to a new level because it's not just the fact that more people of faith are being put under pressure. It's that there's a carefully thought out strategy. The simple word that people need to understand is a word called sinicization. And it's the idea from President Xi, it's his idea that every religion in China will be sinicized. And that means that it'll ostensibly have a Chinese version of that religion. But I mean, we're talking about Christianity, we're talking about Islam, we're talking about Buddhism. All these faiths would claim to be world faiths. Mm. They have their own doctrines, they have their own practices that are not peculiar to a particular nation. But President Xi wants to make a Chinese version of each religion.
So just, sorry to cut across yeah. you there, David. So just to clarify, because, you know, I mean, an awful lot of Christians would go and say, let's see what we can do that's culturally relevant here. That is not what he's talking about here, is it? He's talking about, and when he says Chinese, he really means communist China.
He does.
Yeah.
He does indeed.
When he says a communist Chinese version of this.
Yes, absolutely. So, for example, in one of the churches in China, a government official came in the last year, saw a plaque with the Ten Commandments on the wall,
yeah,
and said that's got to come off,
that's
and
got to,
you've got to remove particularly the commandment, thou shalt have no other gods before me.
Wow.
So that is, they're the kind of changes,
wow.
that subversion really of
Absolutely.
Religion that's happening.
Let's just take out the primary commandments, like, it's crazy, isn't it?
And I don't know about how you got on at church on Sunday. Certainly where I was, we didn't have the national anthem sung before the service. I don't know if you looked up the front and saw pictures of President Higgins.
So
it's this kind of thing.
There's this cult of personality, and it's interesting you saying Mao, because Mao was the master of that, wasn't he? He was like, even now his face is like an icon. actually.
Yes, absolutely. You and know. His face is, you know, very often his face and the face of President Xi are being held side by side there in China. You. So we can kind of see where this is going. And unfortunately, it's led to huge repression. We, at the top of the interview, you mentioned about six Uyghur Christians that have been arrested. And I think some people will be familiar with the Uyghur people. And they're predominantly Muslim people in the largest province in China, in Xinjiang province. And the Chinese government has clamped down so hard there. They've made Muslim men cut off their beards. They've made Muslim women take off veils. They've made Muslim people eat during the Muslim fasting month of Ramadan. And they have imprisoned, well, not imprisoned, because they've just detained, interned over 1 million people in what they're calling vocational education centres, what most of the world is calling concentration camps. So Bob Fu, who was over with us...
Absolutely, we spoke to him here. Thank you for organising that.
Yeah. I mean, he has described what's happening as genocide, cultural genocide and ethnic cleansing of the Uyghur people. But just to come back to the people that we've been talking about at this, the top of the programme, among the Uyghur people, which is predominantly Muslim people, there are Christians.
I didn't know that. I was surprised because I saw Uyghur and I thought, oh, these must be Muslims. But then I say six Uyghur Christians, so yes. That's a new one on me.
Yeah, well, I've met some Uyghur Christians.
Yeah.
I travelled there some years ago now, and it is a small minority, and in many ways... they face persecution from the Chinese government, but also their own society maybe feels they're being disloyal.
Getting it on both sides.
Indeed. So let's just read these people's names. And, you know, I'd encourage the people listening to pray for Mehmet Abdullah and Adil Jan. They received a 7-year sentence. Again, for what you were saying, just preaching, gathering together, spreading harmful books, that sounds pretty serious. I'm fairly sure that the harmful book in terms is the Bible,
sure,
or Christian literature. But it's interesting, the Chinese government has been framing charges against Christians in this way, that they're accusing them of subverting the state. And, you know, it sounds really serious charges. But it's just a way of describing what we would see as normal Christian behaviour. And the other names we have, Huji Abjurim, Mamati Yiming Jiang, who is and then a doctor whose last name is Rachman. It's you can gather by the lack of detailed information how difficult it is to get information out from Xinjiang.
I can imagine. Yeah. Can you give us an idea of what it's like? You know, what are these places like? I mean, they're detained. Certainly, you could describe them as concentration camps. So, I mean, is that solitary confinement? What kind of conditions are they in?
Well, there's very few pictures have emerged of these camps. There's an iconic picture that shows just rows and rows of men dressed in blue uniform. One of the most troubling things that we've heard is, and it's predominantly men in these camps, but not exclusively, one of the worrying things is that they're being forced to wear headphones. Mm. And into those headphones, they're listening to propaganda. Mm. Minute after minute, hour after hour, day after day. Mm. And it was interesting, there was a feature in the Irish Times a few weeks ago in which a small group of journalists was allowed to visit one of these centres, and I think the journalists were obviously aware that the visit was strictly controlled, and they said that the few inmates that they were allowed to interview, the responses that they got were so kind of scripted by the Chinese government that it was really so obvious.
Yeah.
But a few people have come out of those camps, and we know from testimony that they've given to family members that they've been broken people.
Yeah.
So very unpleasant conditions, brainwashing involved.
Yeah. Oh dear. Earlier this summer, UN member states, including Ireland, co-signed a letter to China. So can you tell us about that letter?
Yes. This whole persecution in Xinjiang province particularly of the Uyghur people, has reached the international fora to a certain extent. And at the UN Human Rights Council, a group of nations got together to draft a letter calling for an end to what was going on, and calling for China to be open and allow diplomats to visit the area. So I was very encouraged that that Ireland signed that letter. As I said, it was with 22 other member states. Mm-hmm. Just calls on China to do what is the international norms to recognise freedom of religion in Xinjiang and all across the nation of China.
Do they get any reply?
China was annoyed, and interestingly, and just comes back to the fact that China is a very powerful nation now. It organised, we believe this to be true, it organised 37 other UN member states to issue a statement praising China's progress and commitment to human rights.
Wow.
These would be states where there's large-scale Chinese investment.
Okay.
And you can perhaps understand why those states chose to sign that. But, you know, it was a good day for Ireland that Ireland actually stood up.
To be counted.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I always think, you know, we are a small nation and we are not a, inverted commas, powerful nation, even though we have been very influential. But it does require an extra level of courage for a small nation to be able to stand up and do that, isn't it?
Yes, and it was interesting that the way that Ireland chose to act, and indeed the other countries, was to work together on this, so that there were 22 states that made this statement. It wasn't just one or two states going out on their own.
Absolutely.
So when Bob Fu was over here a couple of weeks ago, we got him to launch our new report, which is called China's Crackdown on Christianity.
Brilliant.
And that contains recommendations for our Oireachtas Committee on Foreign Affairs.
And you'll be sending that to them?
We have indeed.
Brilliant.
And we've sent a copy to our Department of Foreign Affairs, and we've even sent a copy to the Chinese ambassador.
Well done.
Asking for international norms.
I'm sure you'd be delighted with that.
I hope.
Delighted to receive that.
I'd love to have the opportunity to talk to him.
But
you know, I'll be looking for that. Whether he wants to talk to me might be another matter.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I want to, we're under a certain amount of time pressure, and I want to make sure we get everything in here. In Iran, two children of a pastor have been refused school diplomas. I was very interested to hear this.
Yes, the pastor's name is Yusuf Nadarkhani.
Oh, you've talked about him.
And his name might be familiar to some people who have longish memories, because he was in prison. And
I remember him.
You remember the name, yeah. So he was under sentence of death, and it was thought that he was going to be executed on one particular day. So I can still remember going to the Iranian embassy, and in fairness to the Iranians, at short notice I was received, and I appealed, as other groups around the world were appealing, for Yusuf's life.
I think you and I spoke that day, or at least one day of either side of that.
I'm fairly sure we probably did.
I remember the story well, yeah.
So he was released after a period. I think he came under pressure to leave the country, but he believes that his place is Iran, and so he stayed in Iran, but he's been back in prison now for over a year or so. But the real issue, which it kind of goes back, it predates the time we're talking about, he's always been concerned about the education of his children in Iran, and they were young children when he took a stand all those years ago. And now he's concerned about his two sons, Daniel, who's 17, and Yoel, who's 15. And the situation is that they have been unable to get diplomas. They've studied, and at the end of the year, because they haven't done Islamic education, which is compulsory, just they've been deprived of their diplomas. So this is a huge bearing on their further education. And it's just another insidious way, really, that persecution affects innocent Christians.
So you're Christian, therefore you don't want Islamic education, but if you don't do the Islamic education, it's compulsory, so you can't pass your high school diploma.
Exactly.
Can't get your leaving cert.
Yes.
So what happens? I presume, again, this is a matter of bringing it to international attention. Any pressure? I mean, I'm just thinking about the Iranian government at the moment. There's a lot of pressure on them in various ways, and they don't seem to be really into giving in.
Well, that's true. The Iranian government is somewhat different to our own government, or the whole structure is different, because the education minister of Iran, I think, is somewhat favourable to changing the situation and how allowing more flexibility, because it wouldn't be just Christians suffer in this way.
Sure.
The Baha'i community has suffered greatly in Iran, and particularly in relation to education.
And they have Zoroastrians, do they?
There's a small minority
there are other minorities other than just Christian.
Exactly.
And can I just ask you, is, like, say for instance, you have Baha'i and you've got Zoroastrian, presumably one or two Jews perhaps as well.
Yes.
Would you imagine that Christians are treated even worse again, or is it just across the board, anybody who's not, you know, Muslim is outside the club?
Yeah, I think really the Baha'is and Christians maybe suffer the most, and I think the reason for that is that just the Baha'is are seen, they're seen as apostates from Islam, the whole community. That's the reason for their persecution. And Christians, in a similar way, because the vast bulk of Christians in Iran, where the church has grown hugely, they are former Muslims.
So they started out as Muslims.
Exactly.
And that's, they would consider that to be apostasy as well.
Exactly. So those are the issues there. So we're just highlighting Yusuf's son's situation and encouraging people to pray.
We're miles over, but can you just give me 30 seconds on Zafar Bhatti and Sawan Massey?
Okay, these are two Christian prisoners in Pakistan imprisoned under the blasphemy laws, appealing against their sentences, and both of them in the last month have had court hearings, and on each occasion, for different reasons, the court hearings were adjourned yet again. So I think in Zafar Bhatti's case, it was possibly the eighth time, and Sawan Massey's case, the seventh time. So both of these men, I've brought up their case at the Pakistani embassy here in Dublin and asked that these delays come to an end and that justice is done in these cases, and we continue to pray and work for them.
Well, let's keep praying about them. In some ways, would you have more hope for is Pakistan a little bit more open or are they not?
It's not easy for Christians in Pakistan at the moment, and that blasphemy law really is the trigger for a lot of persecution.
Yeah, absolutely. David Turner, Director of the Irish Charity Church in Chains, thank you so much for speaking to us today. And don't forget, folks, churchinchains.ie is the website, and info@churchinchains.ie is how to get in contact with them. God bless you, David. Thank you so much. Now, it's been no secret that many political opponents of Donald Trump have wanted to impeach him almost as soon as he took office as the 45th President of the United States, and many of them feel that now is the time. A controversy involving a phone call between Mr. Trump and the Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky has led to the House of Representatives Speaker Nancy Pelosi directing six House Committee chairmen to proceed under that umbrella of impeachment inquiry. So what does it all mean, and how is Ukrainegate likely to affect the 2020 U.S. presidential election campaign? On the line to share his thoughts, we have law lecturer at NUI Galway and political columnist with Journal.ie, Larry Donnelly. You're very welcome back to the show, Larry. How are you?
Great to be with you, Ronan.
So first of all, Larry, you've consistently said that trying to impeach Donald Trump would be a bad strategy, you know, for the Democrats. Do you still think that's the case?
Well, look, I think it could well still backfire on them, but Nancy Pelosi, the House Speaker, her hand was really forced in recent days with the revelations about the Ukraine. When it came to that, when that revelation surfaced, thanks to the whistleblower, she no longer could withstand the pressure within her own party. Previously, it had been in sort of the hard left rump of the party, which had been pushing for impeachment inquiry and impeachment proceedings. With the revelations about the Ukraine, that group swelled enormously, such that she wasn't able to withstand the pressure. I still would guess that in her heart of hearts, she knows this is the political gamble of her life. But again, I don't think she had any choice but to pursue it, and we'll see where it leads now.
So Larry, could you explain to our listeners the Ukraine controversy and why the Democrats have decided to proceed with the impeachment proceedings this time, whereas they hadn't in previous times?
Well, in short, the idea is that thanks to what this whistleblower has brought forward, the president, in a phone call to the Ukraine president, mentioned directly and specifically both the vice president and his son and their involvement in the Ukraine. Indeed, the vice president's son was paid $50,000 a month by a Ukraine oil company at the very same time that his father was the Obama administration point person liaising with the Ukraine. On all sorts of levels, a lot of them involving finance. And a lot of ethical watchdogs have said, geez, that stinks to high heaven, but nothing really came of it. The president raised that in the context of a phone call to the Ukraine president where he was looking for favors of different kinds. And at the very same time, a week before, he had withheld about $400 million of U.S. aid to the Ukraine. So the implication that many Democrats have drawn from the phone call effectively is either you open an investigation into the dealings of the Bidens in the Ukraine, or you're not going to get the $400 million from me. Now, the president and his defenders dispute this vigorously, but that's the clear implication that the Democrats have drawn, and that's what committees are now investigating in the House. And the reason why I think so many Democrats rush to the impeachment mantle is this one is relatively easy to digest for the American people. It's this idea: either you pay the money, either you do the investigation, or you're not getting the money.
Yeah, it sounds a little bit like, yeah, you've got such a nice country there, it would be terrible if something bad happened to it. That was kind of the feeling. I have to say, this is Joe Biden's son, Hunter Biden, and by all accounts, he's kind of a troubled kind of person. Like, there could well be something there on him, but that's not really the essence of what the difficulty is. It's to do with the fact that there was some sense of pressure being brought to bear on the Ukrainian president. Do I have that right?
That's right. That's the essence of what the Democrats are maintaining. One of the very interesting things, and you're right to identify Hunter Biden as somebody who's had a lot of troubles. You're right to identify what the conservative commentator Pat Buchanan has labeled might be the first casualty of the impeachment inquiry, and that is Joe Biden's presidential hopes.
Sure.
Because this is going to cast a serious light on Biden's activities back then, and arguably Biden was acting as a father here. Arguably, he had something of a blind spot for his son. People will know that Joe Biden's family history is particularly tragic, and this might have led, I think, to some of Hunter Biden's difficulties. That is, he lost his mother and his brother at a very young age. His sister at a very young age in a car accident. He lost his own brother just a few years ago. A lot of people say that Joe Biden, who is a very close family man, has a blind spot when it comes to Hunter Biden. That blind spot might actually come back to haunt his presidential candidacy.
Absolutely. So in a way, as I understand it, it's not so much that there haven't been potential impeachment possibilities in the past, but there's something very simple to understand in this particular thing that's going on. So am I right in saying there are even some Republicans who are making, you know, kind of noises in terms of that they're unhappy with what's going on as well, and that maybe they'd like some answers on this whistleblower story?
There are no Republicans who've really come out saying that they want impeachment, that they think this is a good course of action. There are some who are conspicuous by their silence on this and who are waiting to see. The key number on this, and the number of American people who've desired impeachment, has risen since this all first surfaced. It's about a 50-50 proposition in the United States. The key number to watch in terms of whether this has legs is the number of Republicans, ordinary grassroots Republicans, who stand by the president through thick and thin. That number is largely unmoved at this stage.
That's interesting.
However, if that number starts to move, then you might see Republicans in Congress start to defect.
Yeah. So in a way, he can be comfortable enough in knowing that his, not just his grassroots, but the general Republican group in the states are largely on side.
Yeah, I think at this stage he can. But there's a famous saying in Washington that it's not the crime, it's the cover-up. And I think a lot of what's going on now in terms of the investigations of how did the Trump White House react to this, they've also now subpoenaed Rudy Giuliani, the president's personal lawyer, as to what his dealings might have been with the Ukraine. Democrats are going to work very quickly on this because they know the longer it kind of simmers without development, the more the chances are that this will go off the boil and the president can maintain that it's another witch hunt. So they're going to try to produce the goods as quickly as they possibly can, which is no mean feat, to be quite frank. But again, the issue at the end of the day is, are the votes there to impeach the president in the House? Yes, they probably are. And listeners should know that to impeach the president is simply to indict him. That is not to remove him from office.
Sure.
And that is done by a simple majority vote in the House of Representatives, which is controlled by the Democratic Party. To remove him from office, ultimately, you would need two-thirds of the Senate, which is controlled by Republicans, to vote to remove him from office. That would mean that 20 Republicans would have to jump ship. As of now, that still looks like a remote possibility.
Absolutely. So we're still left. I can understand why you mean now when you explain it in those terms, why it might be the gamble of Nancy Pelosi's career, because it could she could yet end up looking very badly after this.
She could, and I mean, she doesn't need to look very far for precedent. I mean, if people remember when Republicans impeached Bill Clinton in 1998, but then failed to have him removed from office, that rebounded rather spectacularly against them in the context of the midterm elections in 1998, where they suffered some pretty severe losses. The American people, by and large, don't like impeachment. I have to be frank with you, I don't like the idea of impeachment, you know, as somebody who's outside the United States. It's ugly. It reveals a real gross underbelly in the American political system that I think is there all the time. It's something we don't want. It's a real kind of ordeal for the country. But that having been said, Democrats have made up their mind that it's their duty to do it, and they do have a lot of American people on their side. That is a key. This is a political process. It would be a mistake to conflate this as a legal. Of course, there's legalities involved, but it is a political process at the end of the day, and the decisions that politicians make always come down to what their constituents are saying.
So your call on how it might affect the 2020 presidential campaign?
It's too early to know. What I do think is I am particularly struck by the point that this is going to draw a lot of unwelcome attention to Joe Biden, who has been the front runner, and I think that if there is a beneficiary there, it's Elizabeth Warren.
Okay.
It would be quite strange if one of the real clear net outcome of this impeachment inquiry were to gift the Democratic presidential nomination to Elizabeth Warren. I'm not saying that's going to happen,
sure,
but it could well happen. In terms of how this all plays out, look, you know, I still think his removal from office is a remote possibility, but look, there are always tipping points. There is critical mass. There is a sentiment out there. Who knows whether it will get ahead of steam? Who knows what the subpoena will reveal from Giuliani? Who knows what the American people might start to think about all this? But at the end of the day, I still think it's unlikely. And if there is a long, drawn-out process, which it probably would be, then I think that the American people will tire of it, and I think ultimately it could help the president, strangely enough.
Sure. No, I understand that. So you've mentioned Elizabeth Warren, and she's kind of the next most likely. Bernie Sanders, Pete Buttigieg, Andrew Yang, any of those people you think might be in with a shout as well, or what do you think?
I've been saying I'm pretty stubborn and steadfastly refusing to say that nobody else has a chance bar Warren, Biden, and Sanders.
Okay.
But the way the Democrats have gone about this is actually quite undemocratic, to be frank. They wanted to avoid chaotic debates like the Republicans had in 2016, where there were 17 people on stage. So they winnowed down the amount of people who could participate in debates at a very early stage. And that has really handicapped a lot of the other challengers who are out there. So what we're left with at the moment are three quite elderly, to be frank, very flawed political candidates going up against Donald Trump in what is an immeasurably important election for the Democratic Party.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really fascinating, and I always find it very insightful speaking to you, that Larry. That's a law lecturer at NUI Galway and political columnist with the journal .ie. Larry Donnelly, thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Thank you, my pleasure. Thank you.
Well, it feels like it's almost gone from summer to winter overnight. And with colder and darker days definitely on their way, in studio to give us advice on choosing autumn fitness routines and planning out fitness goals for the weeks ahead, we have Stephen Kinsella, owner and head coach at FSM Bray. You're very welcome back to the show, Stephen. How are you, man?
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Good. So first of all, Stephen, let's face it, when the weather takes a turn, you know, due to the cold or the rain or the darker days or whatever, it's easy to cut back on exercise.
Oh, yeah. It's kind of a depressant.
Yeah.
Like,
sure.
If it's dark and it's cold, you just want something warm, and it's easy to, you don't want to go and drag yourself through the rain in traffic, because we all know traffic gets worse when it rains.
Absolutely.
To a gym, sweat, and have to get home. It just makes things a little bit more hard and miserable.
Absolutely.
It does dwindle for a lot of people.
And the thing is, like, it's all like exercise almost comes naturally, even if it's just walking during the summer.
Yeah.
Days are long, brighter, with a bit of luck, you get a bit of weather, and it's great. But is it time to start considering, say, a gym fitness routine, something indoors, with the fast approaching darker days?
Well, yeah. Like, if you like being outdoors, and you're finding it that the weather's just too bad, and you're not getting it running enough, or you're not going for your walks, a gym that provides that kind of environment of social activity. So it's you're getting your fitness, but it's also social, as in like a group training facility, or like a normal gym that runs gym classes, would be good. Again, it's good to kind of try new things as well. So
sure,
it'd be
good,
even 6-8 weeks, you could sign up and book a do classes for 3-4 times a week and see. You never know, you might find a new love for fitness.
And do you find, you know, when you're in the gym situation and you have, you know, there's something slightly more directed, you know, like it's,
yeah.
I mean, even if you don't go for the actual personal trainer looking over your shoulder, there's kind of, you know, people have a way of speaking to each other, like going, have you tried it this way, have you tried it that way?
Yeah.
Do you find that's a positive thing?
Yes. Well, it depends on the approach. Because some people go,
some
people go, don't do it this way, do it that way.
Yeah, yeah.
What I would always go, I would always say is like, I see that's like really impressive, but I think I learned a technique that might be able to make you lift more weight. Because if you say that to anyone, they'd be like, really?
Yes.
And you didn't insult them by saying they're doing it wrong.
Yeah, no, exactly. You know? It's funny, actually. I remember this much older guy. When I say much older, probably about my age now. but anyway, he came up to me at the end of a particular thing. I've really burnt it, you know, on the treadmill for about 45 minutes one time. And he just said this really interesting thing to me, and it really helped me forever afterwards. He said, don't push yourself too hard, because you'll just end up hating it.
Yes.
And then you won't want to do it. And it was a brilliant piece of advice. So simple, you know?
It's simple.
Yeah.
And with kids, like, you gotta, like, when it comes to, like, play, and play is directly, like, it's not just for kids, it's for teens, it's for adults. But if you stop a child from playing before they get bored, they will always want to do that.
Yeah,
while people that do it, they get bored of playing. So if you stop someone in the, like, just before they hit that, I'm done moment, they're going to want to come back, because they're in that prime zone, especially for new people trying new things.
So you're watching for that?
Yeah. Well, you try to. You can't always watch everyone.
Yeah, sure,
you're trying for that with members. Yeah.
So Stephen, when it comes to getting serious about exercise, many of us think of the 1st of January as the only window we have to hit reset on our healthy routines, and of course all that stuff. But autumn is actually not a bad time too, isn't it? It's a kind of another kind of
new
year.
Everyone's back to school, routines kick back in, parents kind of go, like, in all fairness, routine is king when it comes to putting it in your schedule. So September, October, like, any time is a great time to start. Like, it's not going to happen tomorrow, because we all know that saying, like, tomorrow will never come. Like,
sure.
So you start it today. And it doesn't have to be anything crazy. As I've always said, you can start off small and build it. The thing is, people think they need to commit to 4 hours a week and do this, and then they're looking at pricing and all. It doesn't have to be. If you don't exercise and you start doing 2 days a week, and then you love that and you do 3 days a week, build it up. But this time next year, you're an everyday exerciser, which is what we want everyone to be, but you can't just go hammering thongs at the beginning.
And by the way of a kind of encouragement to the listeners, do you feel better pretty much immediately from the moment you start to exercise?
As soon as you start exercising, you're starting to release different hormones.
Okay.
You're going to get that feel-good factor from exercise no matter what. Yes, you're going to go up against the whole, you're going to get a little bit tired. You're going to have muscle soreness. A lot of people get muscle soreness, then they'll stop because they're so sore.
Yeah.
The first thing you do with muscle soreness is keep moving, because fresh blood goes to the muscles to help them recover quicker.
So
the more exercise you do to a point will actually help you. But yeah, you do. Firstly, it's going to flush your skin out. It's going to flush toxins out of your skin through sweating.
Sure.
You're going to start feeling better. Your skin's going to start looking better. You do find a new, especially if you exercise in the morning. I know not everyone can exercise in the morning, but it's been kind of proven. Anything I've read on it is that if you exercise first thing in the morning, you're going to have a much more productive day.
Wow, very good.
Because it's you've kind of slayed one demon as soon as you got out of bed.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. And you do, it does, even just psychologically, you feel like, wow, look what I just did. It's resilience. You look,
exactly,
wow, I didn't think I was going to be able to do that. Look what I did. So what advice would you have for setting goals as we approach the autumn and winter months?
Well, depending on the goal, but if it's for like kind of the general like,
Say it's somebody, just general person coming in and saying, I want to get a bit of fitness in, want to make sure that I don't lose it over the winter, want to maybe lose a couple of pounds. What you know, so it's not really somebody looking to maybe build weights
I would say, like, to anyone that's going into any sort of fitness endeavor is just plan it. Plan your consistency of it. So, like, sit down on a Sunday and write, I'm going to train at these times. What do I need to do to make sure I get to train at these times? These are my exercise times. And it's like brushing your teeth. If you put it in your diary and it's one of those, it's going to be long term.
Yeah.
And then it's consistency. And ask any coach worth their salt, if you're consistent in what you're doing and you frequently challenge your body, you're going to, all the weight loss, strength gain, fat loss is going to happen as a byproduct of the consistency of training.
Yeah, and you know, say you as, you know, somebody who's kind of directing other people in fitness, do you try and keep it fairly varied to keep it interesting?
Yes.
Or would that be in the back of your head when you're trying to put together a program for somebody?
Unless it's a very specific goal, you have to vary it, because firstly, the body responds to a different challenge all the time, and it's a better stimulus, I think, psychologically. It's motivating. You can then retest stuff, but if you're doing the same stuff over and over again, kind of the definition of insanity, you're going to get bored with it.
Of course.
Unless you're very, like, if you're a bodybuilder and you have a competition in 6 months, you have to train specifically and repeat the same stuff to that day, but there's a goal at the end of it. So training like an athlete and training like someone that just wants to be stimulated and have fun, and for 99% of everyone that goes to a gym in Ireland, it's an outlet. It's a stressor. It's a stress relief.
Yeah, exactly.
And you want it to be a stress relief. You don't want it to be the stressor. You want it to be stress relief.
Exactly. Like my old friend said to me once upon a time, you know, because I was stressing myself, actually, as it happened. So what we do is we're basically setting ourselves, as you say, kind of tangible milestones. Mm. You're saying these are your goals, and you set the goals out. You try and keep it as varied as you can. What about the kind of your fitness gear? Is that important to be wearing the right attire, or does it really matter?
Whatever you feel comfortable in.
You'll know pretty quickly, won't you?
There's gym etiquette.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can spend a fortune.
Yeah.
On runners and the training gear and the Fitbits and all that stuff. And if that's your gig, like I wear specific gear. Yeah. I order my own stuff. Very rarely buy other people's stuff. We order our own stuff because I like it.
Yeah.
But realistically, if you like to train in flip flops,
yeah,
and
if that works.
Your gym lets you do that.
Yeah.
We don't, by the way. we don't.
That's right. Yeah.
But if that's your jam, if you do the barefoot running, or you like to wear a full length tracksuit, or you like to wear a vest top and shorts.
Yeah,
just some gyms obviously have appropriate etiquette wear,
which is fair
enough.
Yeah,
and we have a very kind of an etiquette wear in our gym. Yeah. But whatever kind of makes you feel comfortable in yourself when you're exercising, that's the main thing. Like, it's about you feeling comfortable. It's not about, because you're going to be uncomfortable when you exercise.
Well, exactly.
Yeah.
So, and you'll know soon enough if something's catching or something's creating rubbing or whatever it is, you know, a problem, or if your trainers are kind of catching you in the wrong way or something.
Exactly. Yeah.
From your experience, do gym goers and those with fitness goals, do they usually stick to their own individual goals, or are group classes good for kind of, you know, those who might lack motivation?
Group classes are very good for people that need more than just a goal. Because goal is motivating.
Yeah.
And motivating, it dwindles very quickly.
Yeah.
As a good coach told me before, a pain goal is more stronger than a motivating goal.
Okay. Like,
so if you have, let's say you have something coming up, like an event, like a school reunion, and there's someone there that you used to go out with or something, and they dumped you and you were heartbroken over that, it's a pain goal because you're more determined to prove proving someone wrong. Now, I'm not glorifying the pain goal.
Yeah, but I know what you mean.
If you
concentrates the mind.
Split up with someone and you're going to meet them 6 months later, you know you're going to, like, you want to make sure that you look good and they're like, oh, wow. Oh, did I make a mistake here?
Look what I messed up. I missed out on there.
But yeah, it's group classes help that because there's a social aspect to it, there's a community or a tribe, and like, even if you're having a bad day, you're going to go there, and then you have coaches that are obviously going to motivate you as much, but then there's like Valerie and Fiona and John and Colin, they're all there they're bumping you up, because always there's out of the four or five people, or in our case like 12 people in a room, there's always going to be two or three that are on a high. And then there's days where they're not on the high, and other people are on the high, and it's a motivating aspect,
and it moves around and then we are social creatures, you know,
we are,
and you kind of pick up that enthusiasm from others, particularly when you're not feeling so good. So before I let you go, Stephen, advice for sticking to an exercise routine, particularly as you're kind of getting a bit bored with it.
If you're getting bored with your routine, I'd say look into changing one or two. Don't overhaul it, but changing one or two things up, and set more kind of short-term goals that are achievable. So in 4 weeks, I want to do this. So the simplest one would be, if you're training 3 days a week and you want to continue that, pick a goal, something that you're going to reward yourself with. So if I hit my 3 sessions, 12 sessions a month, I'm going to give myself. Now, it's not a blowout pizza night or whatever. But if it's, I'm going for dinner, or I'm going to treat myself to a top or a new pair of runners, those little goals are good. Like, we did it with one member. She had an 8-week goal. And I said, if you're consistent in your training, I said, what's the thing? And she goes, and this woman would be in her 40s.
Yeah.
I love to go to raves. I'm like, firstly, would have never expected this woman to want to go to raves. I said, well, when's the next rave? And she's like, oh, well, it would be in such and such. And I said, well, hit your sessions, then give yourself that weekend and go to do your rave.
Brilliant.
And she was like, and she went, she had a great time.
Yeah.
And she just never thought of it like that.
Amazing.
And it just is whatever, like, whatever can keep you motivated.
Yeah, absolutely.
Like, it's go to the cinema, or it's listen to Spirit FM.
Yeah, keep your head in the game. Absolutely.
Exactly.
And the reality is that, you know, you will always be happy if you can keep your head in the game, because you look and you go, wow, look what I managed. Stephen Kinsella, owner and head coach at FSM Bray, thank you so much for talking to us this morning. And let's remember, folks, fsmbray.ie or on the Facebook. FSM stands for Functional Strength Movement. So you can check them all out there. Thanks, Steve. We've talked a couple of times about a review being carried out by the Department of Education on relationships and sexuality education, and the curriculum being taught to students in both primary and secondary schools. There's a consultation deadline coming up, so we thought we might like to talk to a parent about what might be coming down the track and how parents and others can input to the process. On the line now to tell us more, we have Charlotte McQuaid-Bruin, a parent with young children and living in Loughrea in County Galway. You're very welcome to the show, Charlotte. How are you?
Thank you, Ronan. I'm good, thank you. How are you?
Good, not bad at all. First of all, Charlotte, tell us, what is this review and why have you taken such an interest in it?
Okay, well, the review was started in April 2018 by the then Minister of Education, Richard Bruton. So he asked the National Council for Curriculum and Assessment to review the RSE programme in schools so that it would include consent, contraception, LGBTQ plus matters and other matters, so as to reflect, I suppose, a modern Ireland.
Sure.
The reason why I became interested in it is, obviously, like a lot of your listeners, I have young children.
Yeah.
And I realise, perhaps not like many others, there are quite a few, but not everybody is aware that we have a problem already with sex education in our schools.
And what is that?
So, for example, when I put my oldest boy, who's now 7, into junior infants, and we had the SafeSafe program, I didn't know what it was, so I had a look at it. I realized that they were introducing the concept of paedophilia with a paedophile babysitter. I didn't want the story to be conveyed or to be read out when my child was present. He was only 5.
Yeah, really inappropriate, I would have thought.
Really inappropriate. Now, we already have some explicit stuff going on in national school and definitely in secondary school, especially with external agencies. a lot of parents don't really know what is being taught in those programs, and consent forms don't reflect that.
Sure.
For me, I want to make sure that my family values and our family values are passed on to our children.
So can I just ask you, Charlotte, I don't want to cut across here because I want to give you a good time to get your total thing, but just so I'm clear, this is not about... It's not about safekeeping as such, is it? It's not about, like, because presumably you would want a child to be able to know sufficient to be able to go, no, that's not cool, and I don't think that's and I want to report that. This is different. This is something else, isn't it?
Yes, and what is already going on is a program called Safe, which was created in consultation with the group 1 in 4. I still don't want my child exposed to that, but what is going on now is the NCCA review to reflect more explicit content, like okay. talking about consent, contraception and LGBTQ plus matters down to national schools.
Yeah.
And they've referenced the WHO document, which speaks about down to 0 to 4. This is the NCCA referencing the WHO document.
And tell us, Charlotte, do you feel that it's because it's just too, the kids are just too young to be able to engage with this information,
yeah,
or is it something else?
Whether you think your children are too young or not, or I think my children are too young, or maybe they're not, it is my right and it's actually my responsibility to decide what is age appropriate and not for somebody else to prescribe it. And
okay.
I want to have these conversations, of course, they're very important conversations to have with your children, at the age you decide, and with while instilling the morals and values. When you're talking about issues of huge personal consequence, it's also really important for parents to protect the age of innocence.
Sure, absolutely, yeah.
And to work on your parents' instinct to protect your beautiful children that are playing and using their imagination and building and developing motor skills and social skills that don't need to be thinking about these other things and things that are not appropriate for them to be thinking about.
Sure. And again, that feeling that you would have of, first of all, it's you know, that it's up to the parent really to decide what's going to work for their child because nobody knows them better. Am I catching that right for you?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And also to instill your family values while speaking about these really important issues. Yes.
Yeah,
and it's for you to decide and for me to decide. There are a few other aspects to it, I suppose, it's good for people to think about. There is talk about, you know, on the back of this NCCA research paper that was published in November of last year, which was the first part, really, the first public part that we saw about this NCCA review. They spoke quite poorly about a parent's approach to sex education being too future and consequence oriented. And after it, we saw mainstream media articles speaking about what's going to be taught in these classes. Now, there is no curriculum yet, but this is only to go, this is going on mainstream media articles. So LGBT issues, consent, contraception, abortion, and probably most worrying is pornography.
Yeah.
Now, we don't know what the material is. We don't know what they've deemed age appropriate, but they speak about teaching tools and teaching aids being used. It would be good to know what these things are. It's all going to be talked about without any reference to morals or right or wrong. And there's talk about sex inspectors being sent into the classes to check on the learning of the students after the classes. Now, that is really disturbing. In the past, unfortunately, people made mistakes and allowed unsupervised access to their beautiful children and trusted that people would, I suppose, respect them. But now, what we're talking about is handing over the same trust to strangers or relative strangers to talk to our children about really important issues, and maybe to force our children to talk about these issues when they don't want to. I would consider that abuse and grooming.
Sure.
I definitely
okay.
would.
So just again, just to be absolutely clear, you know, there are definitely people out there who'll be listening in today and they'd be saying, look, really, the reason all this is happening is because there's been a tremendous amount of you know, people, first of all, not just understanding, but then taking their lack of understanding and really kind of being prejudiced and biased against kids who may have LGBTQ or I or whatever. There's these other, you know, and that in a way what we're trying to do here is develop a kind of, not a common understanding, but a tolerance. So we're not, that's not really what you're talking about, is it? It's not that you don't want your kids to be, to lack tolerance towards others. It's the fact that something is coming in from outside, that somebody is deciding something that is really a parenting issue. Is that if the philosophy has moved from, it's, this is the parent's job to look after this, to we'll tell you what you should be doing?
Yes, that's how it feels. I mean, okay, we should all be teaching our children to love and respect everybody.
Yeah.
But that does not mean you have to agree with other people's behavior that you have learned is immoral. Yeah. And I think that is the important distinction, is that it's a parent's job to speak to children about love and respecting other people.
So, Charlotte, tell us, what stage is the process at? We're at the kind of draft stage, or what exactly is going on?
Yeah, so there was the research report that was published in November 2018, which is quite alarming in different parts. There was then a survey, which was a monkey survey online, and the NCCA were open to written submissions. There was a draft report published in July, and it was a report of the survey. It claimed that the vast majority of parents, teachers and pupils who filled out that survey all want more explicit sex education. And now at the moment, there's a further survey on the NCCA website. The deadline, as you were saying at the start, is later this month. I think it's the 25th of October, but it's really important that people fill in the survey and at every opportunity state whether they agree or disagree with the statements, and state clearly if they were not included in the last survey and that their opinion was not taken included in that draft report.
So where do people go to fill out this survey, Charlotte?
So it's ncca.ie, and you'll see all the links to the reports, to the research paper and to the surveys, and it's really important that you have your say.
So ncca.ie, and go to the consultations. I think it's a consultations thing, and then you can go in there and fill it in there. Very important, as you say, particularly if you haven't been consulted before, that you let them know, listen, I wasn't consulted, and particularly if you're looking at something and going, wait a minute, that statement doesn't sound right to me, and let them know. What changes to the RSC are likely to happen as a result of this review, do you think?
Well, all we can go by is the mainstream media articles that I was speaking about. LGBT issues, consent, contraception, abortion and pornography. Now, meanwhile in the background, there is a bill, an Rockets Education Bill of 2018 that is before the Dáil. It is at the third stage. It was put forward by, let me see, Ruth Coppinger, Mick Barry and Paul Murphy. They've had an Oireachtas Education Committee, and their report in January of this year were calling for the inclusion of similar topics, so LGBT specific sexual health issues, gender identity and spectrums thereof. So these are the topics that they're discussing. The curriculum has not been made yet. We don't know what the material is or what is what they will deem age appropriate, but that's all we have to go on by now or at the moment. I think it's important for everybody to know that bill is actually calling for the eradication of ethos in our schools when it comes to RSE, and that one, they want it written into the Education Act.
Okay, so just to kind of clarify what that means, so we know that there's a great conversation going on at the moment about schools and parents, and they can uphold the ethos of the school. Are they saying that there will be an exception made for RSE, that when it comes to RSE, this particular thing, that actually it doesn't matter what the ethos of the school is, no matter whether that school is a Christian school, a Catholic school, or whatever kind of school, you will toe the line when it comes to RSE. Is that what they're saying, or am I overstating that?
No, that's it. The bill is very brief. There are only 4 points to the bill, and it's saying that schools and parents, Board of Management and the Minister for Education, they can uphold the ethos of the school except when it comes to RSE. And it actually, in point number 3 of the bill, it says that when prescribing a curriculum for RSE, the Minister for Education must include consent to sexual activity, different types of sexuality, methods of contraception, and worryingly, termination of pregnancy, because this bill was put forward months before the referendum in Ireland, but they wanted it included.
Interesting, isn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
Like getting in ahead of something there. I don't know what it is. There's also, I have to say to you as well, Charles, I mean, I do find, because I'm dealing mostly with young lads, I have to say, in the room, a lot of the time, what happened since about 94, is the pornography thing has become an absolute scourge, because the more it's normalized, the more people go, I don't know why I'm having a problem with this, because actually it's I mean, we do understand from a spiritual point of view what the issue is, but even from a psychological point of view, this is highly addictive stuff. It's not good for you, and it's usually based around, there's people trafficking, it's dirty, it's messy, it's horrible, and it's like, it's a thing that, you know, used to be kind of at least in some way controlled, and it's absolutely uncontrolled now, and kids have absolute access to it. So in a way, the way pornography is dealt with in this particular situation would be really, really vital. I mean, if people turn around, you know, if we're educating our kids to stay away from it and to look after themselves and keep themselves safe, that's one thing. But if there's any feeling of, like, the way it's been normalized within society, I'd be worrying that would lead to some very, very negative outcomes for young people.
I have quite a few thoughts on this, because in our local area here around Loughrea and in Connacht, we have AIDS West that are invited into 40 Connacht schools, their secondary schools, to deliver the RSE program anywhere between junior cert year, so like third year, and leaving cert. Their program developer is a woman called Kate Dawson, who is a pornography researcher. She has called for in mainstream media articles and in TEDx talks and even on British television morning programmes. She has called for the importance of Ireland to realise and to call, sorry, to teach pornography education and pornography literacy in our schools. Mm-hmm. She does not talk about the psychological problem. She definitely doesn't mention the spiritual problem of pornography, the addiction, the effect on our society. It is seen as a good thing, and really all she wants to talk about is ethical and unethical pornography and how we can use it to our benefit. It's like pornography is a major problem in Ireland.
Yeah, it is.
We need to address it in a good way. You can't allow somebody who doesn't have the same values as you to teach your children about pornography.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Important.
So it sounds like what you're saying, Charlotte, is that you're asking people to stand up and be counted. If they have an issue with this, they should really go to the ncca.ie website and go to consultations and fill out one of those forms.
Definitely. People need to stand up and have a say. Now, there are many parents who are happy to pass the responsibility of teaching this stuff to their children. They're happy to pass it on to somebody else, but that does not mean that you should lose your responsibility and your right to teach your children the way that you want to. You need to stand up now. We're protected in the Constitution and in the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and in the European Convention on Human Rights, and in Ireland, the precedents in Irish courts are dealt with under abduction laws, so keeping your children against your will and teaching them something that you don't want taught. Now, in all of these international laws I've spoken about, it is as explicit as saying that, for example, parents, this is the European Convention on Human Rights, parents have the right to ensure such education and teaching is in conformity with their own religious and philosophical convictions. It's not just that we have a right to educate our children. It has to be in line with our own convictions.
Value systems.
So
absolutely.
It's time to stand up and be counted. NCCA survey online.
Okay.
And possibly a written submission.
Lovely.
Spread the word. Talk to your family and friends. Attend local meetings.
Great.
Lovely. Yeah.
Charlotte McQuaid Bruin, a concerned parent from Loughrea in County Galway. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning. God bless you.
Thank you, Ronan. God bless. Bye-bye.
And if you want to be involved in this process, once again, as Charlotte just said, go to www.ncca.ie and go to consultations on relationships and sexuality education, etc.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.